San Diego's talk radio leader, 760 KFMB presents It's Your Money and Your Life. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future, your life, and your leisure. Now, with It's Your Money and Your Life, here are Richard and Joe.
All right, good evening, everybody. My name is Joe Vecchio, your co-host, announcer, and producer, coming to you live from KFMB with 50,000 watts of power. We're heard not just in San Diego County, but Orange County, LA County, up the coast of Seattle, down to Cabo, out to the desert. And now it's time to introduce the main man of the hour. He's a CPA extraordinaire. He is a best-selling author. He's a philanthropist. He's an accomplished long-distance runner. And he is a family office expert in several high-net-worth families. His name is Richard Muzio. Richard, good evening. How are you tonight?
I am marvelous, Joe. Thanks.
Great, great. I forgot to mention there's an app for 760 KFMB, and people want to listen on their smartphone, they can download that app.
Speaking of which, you almost lost your smartphone.
I almost did, but I recovered.
There was panic in here before the show.
It was on the floor, for gosh sakes. I knew I brought it with me, but anyway. We're all good. We're all good.
That's good.
Anyway, you wanted to mention
I wanted to say hi to some friends. Had an interesting week seeing people that we know. Francesco Mustiarelli, famous bike racer from Italy.
Ah, Francesco.
2008 champion in the Giro di Lazio.
Did you get some pasta?
The pride of Pescara. He's opened up his new restaurant and his new bike shop.
Good.
In the Lofts in Encinitas, corner of Encinitas Boulevard and Coast Highway. So everybody check that out. The food is incredible.
So you can pedal and get your pasta vazul at the same
exactly.
time.
Exactly.
Wonderful.
So you can work off all those carbs immediately.
I'm still off the wheat.
Also wanted to do a shout out to the inaugural Fallbrook Half Marathon, which was known as the Avocado Half Marathon. Happened today up in Fallbrook. I need all my running pals to get out and support that event next year because it's an incredible event.
Wonderful.
Hosted by our good friend Milena Gluzak, 1993 San Diego Female High School Athlete of the Year, tennis nerd, and 2001 half marathon champion here in the U.S. It's an incredible course, great event.
Mm-hmm.
Just absolutely scenic running through Fallbrook. Just absolutely gorgeous course in the most quaint village, of course, of Fallbrook. And, of course, hosted by probably the most charming race MC on planet Earth. So just a great event. So everybody check that out next year because we need to get more people out there. Just a great, great event.
Well, Fallbrook's very pretty. Very pretty.
It's lovely. And last but not least, our good friend Malcolm Abner with Conscious Capitalism. You may recall we talked about Conscious Capitalism mm-hmm. in the book that Raj Sisodia mm-hmm. and John Mackey wrote, John Mackey being the founder of Whole Foods. They had their three-day conference here in San Diego mm-hmm. on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. So I attended on Wednesday, heard some great presentations by Professor Sisodia as well as Dove Seidman, who wrote a great book called Why We Do Anything is Everything. So just a great event. Here in San Diego for Conscious Capitalism, www.consciouscapitalism.org.
And that was down at Paradise Point.
That was down at Paradise Point. So it was a great event. So I wanted to say hi to Malcolm Abner and just say what a great event that was.
I think I helped get him some volunteers, so I hope that
I believe you did, and it was a full house, so it was a great event. And,
excellent.
And I figured Conscious Capitalism is a sort of a good theme to sort of, shall we say, segue into our two very special guests tonight. Wouldn't you agree, Joe?
Absolutely. Well, we've got a guest live in Greenwich, Connecticut. I was watching C-SPAN, actually Book TV, earlier this year, a couple of months ago, and happened to flip it on, and there was a very distinguished gentleman railing about Wall Street and all the issues and problems that we've all been hearing about in a very articulate and intelligent manner. He was in the conference room of a law firm in Washington, D.C. that brings a lot of suits on behalf of investors, Acunio Gilbert and DeLuca. And this gentleman, I guess, worked on Wall Street beginning in the early 80s, and he wrote a book called In Bed with Wall Street, The Conspiracy Crippling Our Global Economy. And his name is Larry Doyle. And Larry, how are you tonight?
Gentlemen, I'm doing just fine and thrilled to be on your show. And thanks very much for having me.
Our pleasure. Our pleasure. Also in studio, we have an encore appearance by, he's actually one of the subjects of your book. He's a noted SEC former attorney with the SEC, and now he brings lawsuits on behalf of whistleblowers. And he was a pretty famous whistleblower himself. He's a local here in San Diego, and has been an icon in the law field here. He actually made it in the construction defect years ago. But he's been on the show before, and his name is Gary. Gary, how are you tonight?
Just great. Really happy to be here, especially with Larry.
Great. Our show is called
It's Your... I would say the same if I could. I mean, there's nobody that I've come across in the last 4 or 5 years that I hold in higher regard than Gary Aguirre.
Agreed. You know, our show is called It's Your Money, but our show is not always about It's Your Money. Sometimes we have guests talk, you know, your health is your wealth, so we might have a guest talking about health. But tonight, it really is, it's our money, and where did it all go? But we actually should qualify you a little bit, Larry, for guests who are not familiar with you. You started, well, where'd you go to college, and how'd you wind up on Wall Street? Maybe give a little background on yourself before
sure.
I get in.
Very briefly, I'm a graduate of the College of the Holy Cross.
Mm-hmm.
I got out of there in 1983, and I had the good fortune of an older brother who had worked his way down to New York, got into banking, and then onto Wall Street. And so when I came down to visit, it just, you know, the pace of the markets, the competitive nature, all that sort of stuff just attracted me. And first job was at First Boston, and my first boss was a fellow by the name of Larry Fink, who
mm-hmm.
has gone on to now runs the largest asset management firm in the world. And, you know, I just got involved in the markets, and I loved it, and I continue to love Wall Street. But I also hold a fair bit of what has happened, dare I say, almost in contempt, the fact that, you know, there's been significant issues, and so I'm happy to write about those as well.
Right. So what was your first job with First Boston? What did you do? Because I read in your book, it's, your boss said you won't know anything for a year. So,
so for the first year, I got coffee. But, no, I was on the mortgage trading desk,
mm-hmm.
and within the course of, I guess it was about 9 months or so, I worked my way into trading mortgage-backed securities.
Mm-hmm.
Ended up being a trader for 15 years, at which point I kind of segued into sales and ultimately sales management,
mm-hmm.
and culminated my career on the sell side within the large banks as the national sales manager for securitized products at JPMorgan Chase.
Mm. Now, when you started with mortgage-backed securities, they didn't have the bad name that they took on later in the early 2000s, right?
No, they didn't. I mean, the mortgage market in the early 80s was just kind of the mortgage securities market was in its infancy at that point,
mm-hmm.
And it grew to bring significant liquidity into the market. But like anything else, I mean, they ended up pressing the engine, I guess, so hard that it went from being a quality market to it was garbage in and then ultimately garbage out.
Yeah.
How many years did that take, Larry? Roughly.
Well, I mean, it was a slow process. It wasn't as if it turned on a dime. But I would say that, you know, there were real issues starting to, you know, with the erosion of the credit quality. I would say starting in the probably the late 90s.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just ramped up and to the point where it really was in 2006 and 2007. I mean, a significant percentage of the originations, which were of not only poor quality, but there was real fraud going on as well.
So I think, would you have to agree that a lot of the deregulation that occurred, they even say going back, starting with Carter, and then you got the merger and acquisition mania in the 80s, you had, everyone seems to forget the SNL scandal, junk bonds, Drexel,
yep,
Burnham,
yep,
in the late 80s under the first President Bush. So that was kind of a that was a canary in the coal mine, and everyone thought that was we recreated the Resolution Trust Corporation, which was the largest federal agency since the New Deal. Remember that, to bail them out?
Sure. Well, and what's interesting is that Wall Street, to a large extent, brings the these problems upon the nation, but then profits on the other side of the trade when the government forms these bailout type situations.
Right.
And that has repeated itself numerous times.
Yeah, yeah. So that kind of set the table for the 90s, and then then under President Clinton we had more deregulation. We had I think when the media, the Telecom Act of 96, when they were allowed that to consolidate. Once you can grab hold of the message machinery, then I think it kind of emboldens some powerful people even more. Wouldn't you agree? Because I know in your book you mentioned the oligopolies, and it's occurred in almost every sector, not just financial, but media, airlines, a lot of things, communications.
Well, without a doubt. And actually, this is where I get into, in the subtitle of my book, a lot of people have questioned my use of the term conspiracy,
mm-hmm.
as if it were, a de facto conspiracy. But I said, ultimately, when you look back at it and you look at all the different entities that were involved in it, conspiracy is, in fact, the appropriate term, because there were, you know, this was a control fraud in which senior-level people, not only within the banking institutions, but then also on the political end and also within the regulatory sphere, you know, got paid handsomely either up front or in other form and fashion. So there's just numerous, you know, people and entities and institutions that benefited while the public paid. But there's been no real accountability. And so I think this is ultimately, it's a failure of the government to and the regulators to protect the public interest.
Right. I mean, you talk about Mary Shapiro and then Mary Jo White, both in your book, and they seem to... They came out of the morass that caused a lot of the problem, and then they put them in charge of the SEC, and obviously she's been doing a pretty good job, you think, since she got in. She's done anything that's significant?
Who's that, Mary Jo White?
Yeah.
Well, you know, the thing is, I think the issues, in my opinion, are truly systemic, and then the individuals that they put in place, you know, perhaps try to do some things around the edges.
Mm-hmm.
More often, you know, sometimes or more often than not, for appearance purposes, to try to sell to the public that, okay, you know, look what we're doing. But then those things around the edges either get eroded or don't get passed through effectively. I mean, this Dodd-Frank was more an architectural blueprint than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, Wall Street really answers to nobody but itself.
Yeah. But anyway, Gary, your blog is very heavily trafficked. You get about how many visitors to that, to your blog?
It's, at Sense on Sense?
Yes.
Oh, at my blog? I mean, we've gotten, you know, well over 1 million visitors. We get, you know, thousands of people coming there a day. That blog and the blogosphere in general has provided, you know, the ability for informed opinion amongst private individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And as I've told many people, if it weren't for the blog, there never would have been a book.
Right. All right, well, we're going to take a break right now, Larry. Hang on, we'll get with Gary, and we'll talk about FINRA and all these other great things when we get back right after this. So hang on, everybody.
Now, it's your money and your life on AM 760 KFMB.
All right, we're back. They were winning It's Your Money and Your Life. On the phone is Larry Doyle, who is the blogger at Sense on Sense. That's S-E-N-S-E on Sense, C-E-N-T-S. And Larry, and I want Gary to talk a little bit now, too. Get into auction rate securities, that whole scam and scandal. I don't think enough people, it didn't get covered too much in the press, I don't think. Maybe in the financial press, but not the general press. But can you tell people what happened with that in that $336 billion market and how some people lost their life savings?
It was a sector of the market that, as you mentioned, $336 billion. So it was an enormous, it represented about 10% of the municipal bond market. I mean, 2% of our nation's GDP. And this was a security that, in form and function, really operated like a Ponzi scam. There were, you know, long-term underlying, you know, financings that were, you know, affected, and I don't want to get too technical here, that were sold as a cash form of a surrogate, a cash surrogate.
Mm-hmm.
And then when, the credit market started to get distressed, in 07, then early 08, this market totally imploded and totally froze, and then people could not gain access to their cash.
Right.
6 years after the fact, there's still about $50 billion of this paper that remains outstanding. You know, there's a secondary market, but people would have to take a 20 to 30% discount to par. And again, these were securities that were marketed as a money market type equivalent, a cash equivalent. But little did people know that the Wall Street's own self-regulatory entity, an outfit known as FINRA, they owned $650 million of these bonds, and they liquidated them mere months before that market totally imploded. I would maintain that was a form of insider trading or front-running the market, and they failed to, you know, uphold their mandate to protect investors while they protected their own financial interests.
Yeah. Now, there's a lot of regulatory agencies, but I guess the chief among them and the one that's highlighted in your book is FINRA. So tell people what FINRA is and
Larry, tell people how the leadership structure at FINRA works.
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, to a large extent, I don't think the American public or investors, you know, fully understand or appreciate that Wall Street, to a very large extent, is a self-regulated industry, meaning that the, you know, the large, medium, and even smaller broker dealers, you know, from Goldman Sachs all the way down, J.P. Morgan, everybody else, they fund a regulator so that that regulator can in turn oversee their activities. So, you know, and that on its face is like, okay, that's rife with potential conflicts of interest. Mm-hmm. And when you look at their performance, I mean, I define the regulators at FINRA as little more than meter maids.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, their hierarchy, they do have executives, but there's, you know, significant amount of activity that goes through the revolving door. You know, people from the regulator looking to get to the industry or getting to the SEC and then back and forth. So, I mean, it's the same crowd.
It's kind of like an inverse protection racket.
But in the midst of all this, though, let's just go back a second. They had an investment not only in auction rate securities, but this entity has investments in hedge funds, fund of funds, private equity, the equity markets, the bond markets. So here they're watching over the casino, but they've also got their own money on the table.
And I think you said they have $6 billion in holdings. This is a regulatory agency that's investing $6 billion,
well,
right?
Well, their balance sheet, their overall balance
right.
sheet. So they had about $3 billion in assets.
Okay.
$1 billion in liabilities, $2 billion of shareholder equity, but a large percentage of those assets are invested in the markets.
But how does it make sense if they're going to be investing in entities? Now, what if they have to, investigate one of those entities? They're not going to.
Well, again, this is problematic. They maintain that they're, you know, within their board that they've got committees to make sure that conflicts of interest are mitigated. But much like I expose in the book what they did with their auction rate securities, when the chips are down, how are they really performing? And the problem with this entity, FINRA, is they are not subject to the Freedom of Information Act, and there's no, you know, truly meaningful disclosures.
And yet they claim governmental immunity when they're not even really a government agency.
It's a private organization.
Yeah, and they've claimed immunity. You had to battle them on that too, right?
And nail, and behind those closed doors, you know, God only knows what's really going on.
Right, and FINRA stands for Financial
Industry Regulatory Authority,
right.
And it stemmed from a merger of two other self-regulatory entities in 2007. And that, you know, I detail in the book how I believe that merger transaction was actually, there was misappropriation of funds and lying and everything else going on there,
mm-hmm.
and that was also problematic.
Not to mention possible investment in the Madoff.
There was an allegation in a lawsuit that amongst their investment holdings that they actually had money with Madoff. Madoff and family members were very closely
tied.
Let's put it this way, very closely aligned with many people, you know, going back in the history of these organizations.
Yeah. Boy, oh boy, it's just a real mess. And you would think if they're a regulatory agency, you would be able to get all that disclosed, what their holdings are and their investments and their transactions, and it's almost impossible to find that out, right?
It's very difficult. The problem here is, and it was detailed on February 4th, 2009, the Madoff whistleblower, Harry Markopoulos, went in front of Congress to share everything that he had exposed to the SEC over a 10-year time period. And what he told Congress on that date was, in his opinion, at that point in time, the SEC was deserving of an A-plus in incompetence. They asked him, well, why didn't you bring the information to FINRA? He said, this organization is in bed with the industry and deserving of an A-plus in corruption. Now, be mindful, FINRA reports up through the SEC. So in Madoff's estimation, you had a corrupt organization reporting through an incompetent one. And honestly, over and above that, I think there are certainly plenty of evidence, as Gary is well aware, of scandalous, if not corruptible, activities that have occurred within the SEC as well.
Yeah. We've got a couple minutes to the break, though, but Gary, any thoughts swimming through your head as we go through this conversation tonight?
Well, I think Larry has really nailed it. He's describing really the DNA of financial regulation.
Mm-hmm.
And what you have to understand is that these folks are revolving, you know, in and out of government, in and out of the self-regulating organizations. The self-regulating organizations are now for-profit organizations. So at the same time that they're supposed to be regulating an industry or regulating brokers, they're making a profit. And there are conflicts between their profit motive and their obligation to regulate these industries.
Yeah.
Hey, Larry, did you see the recent story about the SEC attorney named James Kidney? Who?
Again, this is just another item on the you can't make this stuff up. I mean, truly incredible, incriminating. And the thing is, and I'm actually in the midst of reading Michael Lewis's book on the high-frequency trading, and obviously Lewis is a tremendous writer, but I would maintain that James Kidney's retirement statement, which I think runs 4 or 5 pages, actually deserves equal, if not greater, attention than Mr. Lewis's book.
And if people want to look it up, it's spelled Kidney, like the body part, K-I-D-N-E-Y, right. James Kidney.
I think that's exactly right. He defined the SEC as little more than a toll booth on the Bankster Turnpike.
And I think you've even blogged about it on your...
I blogged about that a couple days ago.
Yeah, so it's on there. So anyway, we've got to take our break halfway through the show, Larry, so hang on. We'll be right back after news, sports, and weather. We'll see you in a few minutes. Bye. All right, we're back to the second half of It's Your Money and Your Life, the award-winning show. Over to Richard to thank our sponsors.
We want to thank UBS, our sponsor, among many others. Michael Carancia and Drew Freitas with UBS. Also, Jason Kruger with Signature Analytics, helping business owners who need a CFO have a really, really great one where they don't need one full-time. Our favorite CPAs on the planet, Polito Epic CPAs. Only 3 days until tax season ends, you guys. Hooray. And then there's another deadline, probably on May 15th, right? But they're getting through it just fine. Brenda Geiger with the law offices of Brenda Geiger, specializing in estate planning and asset protection. Across the street from UBS in downtown La Jolla, we got San Diego's best business bank with Mr. Sean Puckett and Steve Sefton. Carl Sheeler with Berkeley Research Group, helping business owners understand the risks that need to be looked at that drive the value of their businesses and how to reduce those risks and improve the value of the business. Carl Sheeler with Berkeley Research Group. Joel Grushkin with Cost Segregation Initiatives, helping real estate owners improve their cash flow. And Lombardi Group, helping CPAs and wealth advisors become great advisors, not just good advisors, great advisors to their very best clients. So we thank all of our sponsors. I was counting up, Joe. I did business. That's 8 sponsors. I did business with 7 of our 8 sponsors last week.
Wow.
One was missing.
And then you go running miles and miles.
Then I go running miles. I was up at 3:20 this morning and at the office at 4:15, and I don't even drink coffee.
Oh, my gosh. So
if I drank coffee, I'd be running around the studio right now.
Superman. But anyway, to reach any of those sponsors, just get on our website, iymoney.com, and put your cursor over sponsors, and you can click on any one of them and get all their information right there, emails, phone numbers, and bios. And Richard's worked with them many years and had great success. So anyway, we're back with you, Larry. You still there? Larry, hello.
Yep.
Okay, wonderful.
Hey, Larry, Gary has a question about being polite. Can you ask him?
You know what? I've been overly polite. I want to hear from Gary.
Yeah, he's got a question about politeness. Go ahead, Gary.
Well, he's talking about James Kidney and his exit.
Well, I think that James Kennedy mentioned the problems you have going after the big banks that you're at the SEC. And one of his comments that I thought was really charming is that if you ever get a chance to interview anybody in the penthouse suites of the big banks, you got to go in there and be very polite and courteous.
Incredible, right?
Well, you know, comparing what happened in, you know, 1929 and the repairs that we made in the 30s, the banks weren't as big. I mean, they had totally failed. I think Andrew Mellon was the Secretary of Treasury, and in 1929, he didn't do anything until he said, let the market figure it out rather than try to come up with some solutions. Here we go rushing in. As soon as they crater, President Obama goes in there, and of course, Henry Paulson, I mean, he came out, went on bended knee. He wanted that $800 billion. He said he actually was going to ask for over $1 trillion, but they were just pulling a number out of thin air, but he didn't think that would set too well with Congress. So. But he's going to ask for $1.2 trillion. But really, it's the industry running the show. There's too much money that's just coagulated in New York and Washington now, and they pretty much run it just for their own benefit primarily. And there's a crisis of confidence, I think. What puzzles me is, you know, unemployment really hasn't been robust or come back. They think the tech bubble might be, you know, ready to deflate a little bit right now. Obviously, the confidence and investment, American, the average investor in the stock market, they've depleted a little bit, haven't they, Larry?
Well, I mean, there is the overall volumes that have been traded on the exchanges, as well as the percentage of individuals holding stock, have both declined significantly. Mm-hmm. But what's troubling is that just recently here, there's been a significant increase in stock purchased on margin. So, as the market has done better, people, I got to get back in. Then not only get back in, but then they purchase stock on margin. And that gets very painful, you know, if and when the market does retrace, which, you know what, right now the market's been kind of running in place and had a tough week this week.
Mm-hmm.
But it gets back to, you know, what did we really learn and what sort of real changes have come about in terms of, true investor protections? And this is what, the government, the public officials, and the regulators, this is their job, and they're not doing their job.
Well, but Larry, question. I read where there's approximately 5 million financial transactions now per second. How do you regulate 5 million financial transactions per second?
Well, I mean, how do you do that? Obviously, You need to make sure that the regulators, have developed their own technical capabilities.
But they haven't, correct?
No, they certainly haven't. I mean, the regulators are, I think it runs the gamut from they're asleep, incompetent, captured, incorrupted.
Mm-hmm.
And so, when you're starting from that point of departure, you end up being light years behind the curve. And this is why you have fellows like Kidney saying, we're here to punch our ticket and then hopefully get a bigger paying job within the general counsel's office of one of the large banks.
Well, it's definitely become a big the game of whales now, and they're squeezing out. Even in your book, you talk about all the broker dealers that really kind of got wiped out, and they haven't come back, have they? There were like 5,000 of them, right? How many?
The number of broker dealers now totally is a little over 4,000. But really, when you look at it, the markets are dominated by these handful, call it a half a dozen type institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what's known as an oligopoly. They hoard information to the point where they're able to manipulate markets and then collude amongst themselves for their own benefit, and everybody else is viewed as little more than prey.
Yeah. So, anyway, we've got Gary here. I wanted to get some more thoughts from him on the whole situation. What might be some, we can talk about high-frequency trading, too. I know Richard wanted to get into that, but what might be some good solutions or suggestions to, obviously, this isn't working. And
why don't we talk a little about transparency?
Okay.
Would you like to chime in on that, Larry?
Well, I mean, to me, it's all about transparencies and disclosures. I mean, certainly FINRA, the self-regulator, needs to be subject to the Freedom of Information Act and should be also subject to an independent outside audit. Gary knows all too well, how pathetic the SEC is in terms of responding to Freedom of Information requests. I mean, I think it's the worst agency within the government.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that I'm just going to chime in on that. I think what we're looking at back in the 20s leading up to the Great Crash was a combination of two dynamics. One, massive leverage.
Yep.
And then the second factor is nobody knew about it. There was no transparency. And we saw a replay of that in 2008. Simply, we had different financial instruments creating the massive leverage, credit default swaps, mortgage-backed securities. But everybody was clueless. Where did it say on Bear Stearns' balance sheet that it had $2.5 trillion in credit default sweeps, CDSs off its balance sheet, which was approximately 2,000 times its net worth?
I mean,
well, yeah, that's a rhetorical question. The answer is it didn't.
Yeah, it's truly incredible stuff, and that's the American public on the hook for that.
So let me get this straight. You know, the SEC and the CFTC, they're funded by the federal government. The FINRA is funded by the industry. If I'm an investor who's been wronged, where would I take a complaint to both institutions or?
Well, ultimately, if you're either an employee on Wall Street or an investor, and if you've got a dispute, you're not going to court. You're going to arbitration, and the arbitration on Wall Street are overseen by the self-regulatory entity FINRA. You can bring a complaint to the SEC, but more than likely you're going to end up in a FINRA arbitration. Mm-hmm. And I've defined FINRA arbitration as a little better than a kangaroo court. Mm-hmm. Not that every case is handled in that fashion. But I look at the overall numbers of cases that are brought. I mean, they torture investors in terms of, okay, how much information that the investor or the employee needs to bring to bear.
Mm-hmm.
But it's torturous trying to get information out of the other side. But when I look at the level of fines that FINRA imposes on the industry, I mean, on an average basis, annualized basis, they've imposed about $50 million in fines since they were formed in 2007. That's on an industry that has bottom line earnings of somewhere between, say, $75 and $100 billion. So, I mean, there's effectively little to no regulation or meaningful oversight from that organization.
Let me chime in on an example of that. There was a FINRA case investigating both Credit Suisse and I'll leave the other bank out for now. but in the Credit Suisse case, they found that Credit Suisse had engaged in 10 million violations over a period of 5 years of something called Regulation Show that's supposed to prevent the creation of phantom stock.
Mm.
The fine was 18 cents a violation.
Oh, gee. Anyway, let's digest that. We got to take a break right now. We'll be right back with more of It's Your Money and Your Life right after this.
It's Your Money and Your Life on AM 760 KFMB.
All right, we're back in the home stretch of It's Your Money and Your Life. And on the line, we have Larry Doyle in Greenwich, Connecticut, who's a master blogger of Sense on Sense and author of In Bed with Wall Street, The Conspiracy Crippling Our Global Economy. You should get the book. It's terrific. And in studio, we have Gary Aguirre, former SEC attorney and now noted securities attorney and represents whistleblowers. So anyway, Larry, let's try to get into some. Where do we leave off, Rich? I'd like to talk about some.
I want to talk about the 08 election and the appointment of Kasami. Because it's just, Larry, you can tell the story. It's a really interesting story about exactly how deep this goes.
Well, I mean, Mr. Kasami came to the SEC from Deutsche Bank. In the general counsel's office at Deutsche Bank. He came in to be the head of the enforcement division of the SEC at perhaps the most critical point in the history of the commission. And, dare I say, kind of talked a good game, but when the chips were down, not a lot of substance really got accomplished. In fact, there was just a story that came out this week in terms of how they would spin things. You know, there was one large fine that was imposed on Goldman Sachs of $550 million, and that was effectively like a kitchen sink type fine. Mm. You know what? They got fined on one transaction, but there was, it was effectively a wink and a nod that, we're not going to come back to you on anything else. So, though, what are those fines? Those fines are little more than a cost of doing business.
Yeah.
So Kasami leaves the commission, and in very short order, he signs up for a $5 million a year job at, I believe, the law firm is Kirkland & Ellis. And, that's the revolving door on, at a warp speed. That's a huge problem.
And I think Gary had something to add right now.
Well, yeah, I think that if you look at Wall Street coming out of the 2008 crisis, this was the moment that there should have been a crackdown. We had people go to jail after the 1929 crash. Obama appoints Mary Shapiro. And then this is the moment to crack down on Wall Street. They bring in a guy from Deutsche Bank, Robert Kasami, who was primarily responsible at Deutsche Bank for supervising the 100 attorneys or so who crafted the credit default swaps and the mortgage-backed securities that brought the market down. So if you were a Wall Street player and you wanted to put somebody in at the SEC and breathe a sigh of relief, it'd be hard to find anybody better than Kusami for that job.
And then in your case, and John Mack, who represented him when he had his trouble, Mary Jo White, right?
Same lady.
In the when she was, working in the private sector as a defense. But they're, obviously George Carlin made the point, it's one big club and we're not in it, unfortunately. But to the detriment, the thing that puzzled me, the market's at 16,000 and it seems like we're in a state of inertia as far as our economy goes. So what's going on with that, Larry? Is it more of an international global whale type thing? Everyone, they've got their money in there and everybody else?
Well, I mean, it's just a massive amount of liquidity that's provided by the central banks, not only our central bank in terms of the Federal Reserve, mm-hmm. European Central Bank, more recently the Bank of Japan, just flooding the market with liquidity, keeping mm-hmm. the overnight interest rates at zero, which compels people to, it's punishing savers and, those who would otherwise invest in fixed income instruments. So that's what's going on there. But, both the costs have been kicked down the road mm-hmm. and accountability has been buried.
Yeah.
And as a result, that's why you've got a serious lack of trust and confidence. I do want to put in a plug here, though, before the show runs out. People who are truly interested in the topics that we're discussing here, please Google Gary's talk that he gave at Notre Dame mm-hmm. Late last year. I mean, I think it was an 80-minute talk. It is an absolutely fabulous talk. And, Gary, you deserve tremendous credit for, just laying it out in detail and in spades in terms of, what really is going on. So kudos to Gary.
Yeah. Well, thanks for those comments.
Yeah, but if you just Google Gary and Notre Dame, you should be able to find it, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
So, perfect. Larry, do you have any plans for a book coming up or not? Another one?
In bed with Wall Street or in bed with Wall Street too. I mean, there's so much material. But ultimately, what compelled me to write the book? Again, the need for real transparency and disclosures. I wasn't even planning on writing a book. I was 3.5 years just at my blog when an agent said, you really got to write a book. And I'm glad that she said that because the book obviously provides a greater platform than the blog. The American public not only deserves to know this stuff, but they need to know this material.
And the book is great because it's it's not overly technical. It's the average reader can absorb it. And the first, I'd say, 90 pages is a good history, an overview of the history of the markets. And then you get into the real your personal stuff. And from there on in, and you tell about Gary's story and other whistleblowers.
Yep.
Those Slomax, you had one family in there. They invested $2.65 million and lost. They're left with $16,000. Did they recover anything else beyond that?
Not that I'm aware of.
Isn't that something?
Again, what happened there is you had oftentimes these high net worth investors who were, strictly prey. They were treated as prey through some of the private banking institutions, entities within these large banks. This is where they would go to lay off the real risk of some of these highly structured transactions. And so not only did the investors not put no, but honestly, many times the salespeople themselves didn't fully understand or appreciate the risks, and they were treated as little more than prey by the those trading and structuring the transactions. So.
Yeah. We've only got a couple really minutes, though, Larry. Gary had a question for you, and we have to wrap up pretty soon.
Yep.
Larry, is there any hope of getting this thing turned around? Do you see anything that could possibly be a dynamic that would wake up the public?
I hate to think that it's going to take another crisis, given the fact that the last crisis should have been reason enough. I'm concerned that it would take another crisis. This is, to me, it's ultimately a failure of leadership on the part of the people both running our country as well as these regulatory entities.
Yeah, I think, you know, when it would all hit the fan last time, they should have let one bank fail and then get those other people out of the business and bring up a new set of C-level folks at these banks, because you keep rewarding bad behavior, and I mean they're reaping in millions of dollars.
But Joe, the issue is it's too big to regulate.
Yeah, I suppose.
Regulate and prosecute. They should have changed management both at the banks and at the regulatory entities, but there wasn't the political will because, you know, they're in bed with the industry.
But anyway, Larry,
Joe, you got to explain why the song is on. Hurry up.
We're out of time, Larry. Thank you very much. And this song is on because this is Gary's son. Gary Jules wrote this. It's a famous song, Mad World, and boy, it sure defines what's been going on. So, Gary, thanks for being our guest tonight. And Richard, always great to see you. Justin Hart on our soundboard. Thanks for making us sound good. Larry Doyle, again, thank you, and Connecticut for being with us. Get his book, In Bed with Wall Street, The Conspiracy Crippling Our Economy. And thanks to Craig Blanke, our account executive, and to Dave Sniff, our programming genius here at KFMB. And you have a great week, everybody, and maybe campaign finance reform. Maybe we'll get into some solutions down the road a bit. So have a good night. Take care. See you next week.
Dreams in which I'm dying are the best I've ever had. I find it hard to tell you. I find it hard to take.